17. At the gate to Skull Creek Camp, there was a signboard announcing a fine of $2,000 for anyone bringing liquor onto an Aboriginal settlement, over which someone had scrawled in white chalk, "Bullshit." We had come here to pick up a Ketij elder called Timmy. He was a relative of Alan Nakamura, on his mother's side, and he knew the dreamings around Middle Boar Station. I unchained the gate and we drove towards a scatter of shiny tin roofs, half seen through the bleached grass. On the edge of the settlement, some boys were bouncing on a trampoline, and nearby, there was a big brown windowless metal box which Arcady said was the clinic. "Someone then called it the death machine," he said. "Now no one will ever go near it." We parked under a pair of ghost gums alongside a small whitewashed house. Songbirds were chattering in the branches. Two full-bosomed women, one in a loose green smock, lay asleep on the porch.
"Mavis," Arcady called.
Neither of the snoring fat creatures stirred. Beyond the gums, set down in a circle around an expanse of red dirt, were about 20 humpies, half cylinders of corrugated sheet, open-ended like pig shelters, with people lying or squatting in the shade. Paper cartons and bits of sheet plastic were flying in the wind, and over the whole settlement there was a glint of glass. Glossy black crows hopped here and there, blinking their jaundice-coloured eyes and pecking at old bully beef cans, until driven off by the dogs. A small boy, recognizing Arcady, shouted, "Ark! Ark!" And within seconds, we were surrounded by a mob of naked children, clamouring, "Ark! Ark! Ark!" Their fair hair looked like stubble in a field of black soil. Flies were feeding from the corners of their eyes. Arcady held two in his arms, a third rode piggyback, and the others pawed at his legs. He patted their heads, squeezed their outstretched palms, then opening the back of the Land Cruiser, he began distributing drinks and lollies. One of the fat women sat up, pushed aside her tangle of hair, yawned, rubbed her eyes and said,
"Is that you, Ark?"
"Hello, Mavis," he said. "How's you today?"
"I'm right,"
she yawned again and shook herself.
"Where's Timmy?"
"Sleep."
"I want to take him out bush."
"Today?"
"Now, Mavis, now."
Mavis heaved herself to her feet and went off lumpily to wake her husband. She needn't have bothered. Timmy had heard the kerfuffle outside and was standing in the doorway. He was a pale, skinny, impish-looking old man with a wispy beard and one eye clouded with trachoma. He wore a brown felt hat at an angle and a red handkerchief knotted at his neck. He was so skinny, he kept having to hitch up his pants. He waggled a finger at Arcady and sniggered. Arcady shed the children and fetched from the car a photo album with snapshots from an earlier expedition. He then sat on the steps with Timmy, and Timmy turned the pages with the furious concentration of a child absorbed in a storybook. I sat behind them looking on. An insistent white bitch with mastitis kept ramming her snout up my crotch. Arcady hugged the old man and said,
"Are you coming with us today, then?"
"Got the tucker?"
asked Timmy.
"Got the tucker. Good."
Mavis sat slumped alongside us. She had pulled her hair over her face again, and all you saw of her was a cracked and pouting lower lip.
Arcady leaned round and said, "Are you coming too, Mavis? We've got Topsy and Gladys from Curtis Springs."
"Nah," she growled bitterly. "I never go no place now. Sit down here all the time."
"No holiday or nothing?"
she sniffed.
"Sometimes we go up Tennant Creek. I've got people there. My mother come from that country. She come from the big boar by the creek. You know that place?"
"I think so,"
Arcady said uncertainly.
"Billy Boy Mob's country," said Mavis,
rousing herself with exhausted dignity, as though defining her right to exist.
"Right up to McLuhan Station."
"And you won't come with us to Middle Boar?"
"Can't,"
she snorted.
"What's stopping you?"
"No thongs."
She stretched out her foot and invited Arcady to inspect her split and calloused sole.
"Can't go no place without thongs. Got to get myself some thongs."
"Have mine," I volunteered. "I've got a spare."
I went to the car, undid my rucksack and pulled out my one and only pair of green rubber thongs. Mavis grabbed them from my hand as if it were I who had stolen them from her. She put them on, tossed her head and shuffled off to fetch Timmy's billion blanket.
"Good on you, Sir Walter," said Arcady and grinned.
Timmy, meanwhile, was sucking at his carton of apple juice. He put it down, realigned his hat, sucked again, and then said thoughtfully,
"What about Big Tom?"
"Is he here?"
"Sure he's here."
"Would he come?"
"Sure he'd come."
We walked towards a shack with a lean-to trellis of paddy melons under which Big Tom was sleeping. He was shirtless. His heaving paunch was covered with walls of hair. His dog began to yap and he woke.
"Tom," said Arcady, "we're going up to Middlebore. You want to come?"
"Sure, I'll come," he smiled.
He crawled out, reached for a big brown shirt and hat, and pronounced himself ready to leave. His wife, Ruby, a spindly woman with a dizzy smile, then crawled out from her side of the shelter, covered her head with a green spotted scarf, and said she too was ready. I never saw two married people pack up and get going so quick. We were a party of six now, and the smell inside the Land Cruiser was rich and strange. On the way out, we passed a long-limbed young man with fair hair, in rat tails and a reddish beard. He was lying full length on the dirt. He had on an orange T-shirt, washed-out red jeans, and around his neck there was a Rajneesh rosary. Four or five black women squatted round him. They appeared to be massaging his legs. Arcady tooted the horn and waved. The man nearly managed a nod. "Whoever's that?" I asked.
"That's Craig," he said. "He's married to one of the women."